You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
Michael Long, welcome to KAZI Book Review. And Randall Maurice Jelks, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hopeton. It's great to be with you.
So, Michael, I found it was kind of interesting to learn that you were put onto the Jackie Robinson projects you've done initially while you were researching Richard Nixon, and that someone told you about the correspondence between Nixon and Jackie Robinson. So tell us that story.
Yeah, I was. I was researching Richard Nixon and Billy Graham, believe it or not. And I was at the archives in Laguna Niguela in California. And the good archivist there came up to my desk and said, "Hey, Mike, have you seen the Jackie Robinson files?" And I said, "No, but I'd love to see the Jackie Robinson files." So I brought out this big file of correspondence between Robinson and Nixon, starting in the 1950s, and it ended in 1972. It was full of information about their perspectives on politics, economics, sports, you name it. They had a friendship for a long time, and I was just captivated. So I really got into the Robinson projects through his politics primarily. Most people get interested in Jackie Robinson through sports, as you might imagine. But my real hook early on was his politics and his interest in civil rights.
So Randall, how were you first introduced to Jackie Robinson, not as a fan, but as a scholar?
Oh, well, it starts off personal for me. Jackie Robinson, my father was in professional sports. My father was to be the second black umpire in the National League. And then the National League president at the time refused to bring him up to the major leagues. He had established a relationship with Mr. Robinson in the 50s through barnstorming baseball. And he met Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and all of the Giants, and he worked for the New Orleans Park District, and he upped the game, and they said, "You're really great. You should come up." The year I was born, he got his call from baseball and went into the minor leagues and then to AAA baseball out in the Pacific Coast League. He and Emmett Ashford, who was the first black umpire. So I always knew about Mr. Robinson as it would never be Jackie to me. And so that's that. Baseball was how, and my own kind of family history is how I discovered Jackie Robinson.
Michael, with all the books you've done on Jackie Robinson, the letters, et cetera, what prompted you to put together this collection of essays and to recruit all these wonderful writers?
One of the things that prompted me is dissatisfaction and frustration with the way we've treated Robinson recently. When I look at the Jackie Robinson Day celebrations in Major League Baseball, they usually focus only on 1947, and that key year when he shattered the color barrier in Major League Baseball. Did he shatter it? No, but he really sort of overcame it a little bit here and there. But I think that we've frozen Robinson in 1947. That's the year he turns the other cheek. That's the year he soldiers on nonviolently. That's the year he swallows all those racist taunts, the N-word and everything else, and turns them all into muscle. It's a great year. It's a heroic year. It's a courageous year. But Rachel Robinson has always wanted us to know that Robinson was much more than he was in 1947. He was much more than a baseball player. He was also somebody who was a courageous freedom fighter, not only on the diamond, but far beyond baseball as well. So I wanted to present Robinson in this multidimensional way and focus especially on areas that were given little interest. And that's why I focused on the legacy book. And so I reached out to writers like Professor Jelks and others, including New York Times writer George Vesey, Ken Burns, Jonathan Eig, who's done a great book on Muhammad Ali, and lots of other writers. And Robinson still has that magnetic power, that magnetic draw. And so it was easy for me to garner all these writers and to enlist their interest.
Yeah, no. And I would just want to jump in with Michael. One of the things that, as I became a professional historian, that struck me was Robinson's writing in the New Amsterdam newspaper in Harlem. and his critique of Malcolm X. People forget that Jackie took Malcolm X as fierce a debater as Malcolm X was. Jackie took him to task, saying, "I never, forget this. Look, Malcolm, you're in Harlem. You're not going down south and getting your head batted." Right. He was a fierce advocate and freedom fighter. And for someone like my father, not just that Robinson, the baseball player, but that Jackie Robinson also became a businessman. And that for my father's generation, that was epitome of Black male excellence in that regard.
And I think it's also interesting that he was, I'm not sure he was a Republican. I know he was a registered independent, but we do know that he endorsed Richard Nixon for president in 1960.
He was a Republican, and many Black people were.
Right.
Up until the election of Ronald Reagan, Black people, maybe around 10% of the party, lots of people, Maynard Jackson's grandfather was a Republican. People remained in the Republican Party for a variety of reasons. Remember, the Democrats in the South were the party of white supremacists.
Right, but I do realize that, because there's a whole essay on that Jared Early writes about him being a Republican. But one of those essays, they said he was a registered independent, which I thought was interesting, even though, of course, he endorsed Nixon in 1960, opposed him in 1968. But being that businessman Republican sort of set this different ethos that we have the Democratic Party pushing toward much more government involvement and providing financial support for the community, and Jackie Robinson going toward the Black capitalism, and in a manner of speaking, the Republican build your own business, be independent type of side. So I'm interested in that. But let me jump back, Randall, to the AME Church and the importance of the AME Church, or African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the church he went to in California that really helped to shape the moral legacy of Jackie Robinson. Talk a little bit about his family's involvement in the church and how that pastor actually ended up mentoring him, including recruiting him to be an assistant baseball coach at Houston Tillerson University, which today, back then, was called Samuel Houston College.
Yeah. Well, Robinson's family belonged to the Methodist Church, the larger denomination, what we today call the United Methodist Church. They were Methodist Episcopal, so they would, and that meant the structure of their how they governed themselves. Episcopal meaning that you have bishops in a hierarchy. Other Protestants don't have that hierarchy, and so the church he grew up in was named after a famous Black Methodist who went on to Liberia, become the president of a college in Liberia, came back, was a part of the Chicago Exposition, Isaiah Scott. So that church had its own sense of dignity to name it after a Black Methodist bishop, the first Black Methodist bishop in the United Methodist. Rachel Isom, was the person who belonged to the AME Church, and the African Methodist Episcopal Church, of course, sojourns back to 1794 in Philadelphia when Absalom Jones and Richard Allen and all those other people lead out in protests at St. George Methodist Episcopal Church over segregation of the altar and prayer time. So Robinson's formed by this, and what's luckily for him is that Downs comes to that church. He is a social progressive Methodist. He is in the era of what I call, and others would call, the Black social gospel. And which I wrote a book about Benjamin Mays, who's one of these promoters of that they are promoting a much more liberatory, whether it's Baptist or Methodist, a liberatory moment, and that the church had to be engaged in social problems. And they had to take on social problems and social issues in their their communities. And Downs is one of those young people, a young minister and clergy, and he comes to that church and he captures Robinson's imagination. Robinson's hanging around. He's a street tough by then. And his mother is worried, like all mothers are worried, that this kid's going to go end up in jail or somewhere like that. And, you know, he's an angry and frustrated kid because they're living under their, he's reared by a single mother. They don't have a lot of money. And his older brother is a superb athlete, a super athlete as well. And you know, so the Methodist Church plays a big part of it. And Downs, as this young progressive Black minister, changes Robinson's direction altogether.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guests are Michael G. Long. He is the editor of 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy, and one of his contributors, Randall Maurice Jelks. Now, Michael, earlier you talked about how so often that Jackie Robinson is just viewed from integrating baseball in 1947. And there is an essay, The White Media Missed It, by Chris Lamb. And that essay talks about how the white media in their coverage of Jackie Robinson basically refused to put it into context of the civil rights movement and the social impact that it had, that they basically didn't really interview him and get quotes from him for their stories. It was almost like, if I might say, a whiteout. So talk a little bit how the white media treated the story of Jackie Robinson as expressed in that essay.
Wow, that's a fascinating look at it. But yeah, according to Chris Lamb, contributor Chris Lamb, who's a great contributor, and I encourage you to read his book on this very topic. He makes the case that Ricky, Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Dodgers who brought Robinson up, was really strongly pushed to do so. Ricky was a pious Methodist, to piggyback on Randall's point. He was a pious Methodist, and he believed in racial integration. It took him a long time to bring Robinson up, but he believed in racial integration. But he was strongly encouraged to bring Robinson up because he had a couple people really pushing him. The Black news media, especially Wendell Smith, Pittsburgh Courier, the New York Amsterdam News, Chicago Defender, all these great Black newspapers were really pushing Major League Baseball to racially integrate. And so were white communists at the same time. The Worker, the Daily Worker, a communist newspaper, was a big believer in racially integrating Major League Baseball too. And they would, these groups, Black newspapers and the Daily Worker and other communist newspapers, lobbied liberal progressive white politicians to put pressure on to sports teams owners. And this happened in New York. So Ricky felt pressure from Black newspapers, the Daily Worker, and progressive politicians to integrate Major League Baseball, at least the Dodgers. And eventually does so. And when he does so, he's heralded by Black newspapers, the Daily Worker. But the white newspapers, according to Chris Lamb, they really missed the story in the sense that they don't see it as significant as Black newspapers, because Black newspapers have put the historical context of racism into Robinson's story. And they depict Robinson's story as a major landmark in the move toward Black civil rights. White newspapers don't do this because they don't see it as a story about racism. Why not? Because they were part of the racist story that led to the shattering of the color barrier. 1945, the New York Times runs this skit, and it's covered in the book. And it was a skit put on by New York sports writers. And in the skit, Robinson, no kidding, appears as a Black butler to a Southern white aristocratic family. It's a hideous skit. But the skit was put on by New York sports writers who were part of this racist system that denied folks like Robinson for so long. So, of course, you're not going to write about the racist history that led to April 15th, 1947, because they fueled that history. Anyway, it's a great story, and I encourage you to read Chris Lamb's article in the book.
Randall, what was your perspective when you were reading about Jackie Robinson? Were you getting the Black media perspective? Were you getting the white perspective? What was the discussion around your household about Jackie Robinson?
Well, Jackie Robinson made all of us. So like you growing up in New Orleans, we didn't have a baseball team. So we wound up, many of us rooted for the Cardinals because they were National League. So I was a National Leaguer. I mean, when that meant something back in the day because of Jackie Robinson, that all of the Black players that came in, Jackie Robinson. When I was rereading stuff about Hank Aaron and him talking about Jackie Robinson, just Robinson meant, Jesse Jackson once said that when Joe Louis died, Joe Louis carried the Black community on their shoulders. I often feel like Jackie Robinson did too, because people rooted for him, cheered for him. There's a wonderful article in the book about Jackie's Black women fans in the book, and it to me, Robinson's legacy. I was born in '56. Oh, I'm dating myself, but I was born in '56. But Robinson's legacy still lived in my family until he died in 1972.
Yeah, Hope, so, if I may jump in here as well, you know, Robinson not only changed the color of skin in Major League Baseball, according to one of the contributors, who's George Vesey, many years a writer for the New York Times, he transformed baseball itself. And so what he did in 1947, he injected play from Negro Leagues baseball into white Major League baseball. And Vesey makes the case that when we see people taking that long turn at first base, and when we see them dancing between the bases, when we see them stealing home plate, when we see the hard slide, he says, that's Jackie Robinson ball. It wasn't like that before Robinson. What Robinson did was brought Negro Leagues ball into white Major League baseball and made it more exciting. Now, what's happened recently is that it's been all tamped down by analytics. It's less exciting. And Vesey wishes we'd go back to Jackie Robinson ball, and I'm sort of with him.
Yeah, I'm with him too. Small ball, bunting, just trying to knock the ball out the park.
Right, yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guests are Michael G. Long. He is the editor of 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. And Randall Maurice Jouts, he is one of the contributing essayists to 42 Today. So there is a essay called Before the World Failed Him by Sridhar Papu. And that was such a fascinating essay, and I'd like for both of you to comment on it, because it talked about the hope and the optimism that Jackie Robinson had at the beginning when he became seriously active in the civil rights movement, when he was considered a radical. And by the time he was attending the Martin Luther King funeral in 1968 in Atlanta, he was behind the times. He was considered part of the past, and in at least one case was considered an Uncle Tom. And I think it just sort of, for me, it sort of just tells the world like it is, as much as we may always want this optimistic, happy ending to the lives of our heroes, that the reality is the struggle is so long that for many, it goes far beyond their lifetime. We'll start with you, Michael.
Yeah, that's a really moving chapter. Sridhar does a great job there. From 1956 on, Robinson plays a major league in the a major player in the civil rights movement. Rachel says that he becomes an informal civil rights leader. So in 56 and 57, he's leading the NAACP. He works with Dr. King. He goes to the Albany movement. He goes to the Birmingham movement in 63. He goes to the March on Washington and speaks in the preliminary list of speakers. August 20th, 1963, he builds a Black bank in Harlem. He lobbies politicians. He's constantly lobbying for civil rights legislation. This guy is a huge civil rights player. He doesn't have the type of constituency that Dr. King did or that Roy Wilkins at the NAACP did, but he was sort of like a freelance major league civil rights player. He and Dr. King were heroes to each other, no doubt about it. Dr. King said he was a sit-inner before there was sit-ins. He was a freedom rider before the freedom rides, and he's right about that. They differed over the Vietnam War. Dr. King came out against the war, especially on April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Baptist Church. And Robinson really couldn't stomach that. His young son, Jackie Jr., had served there. He earned a Purple Heart there. And Robinson, in this sense, was a big supporter of Johnson and the execution of the war. He was anti-communism. Robinson was. So he and King differ over that. But on this point, Dr. King picks up the phone late night in 1967, maybe, yeah, 1967. And he calls Jackie and the two have a heartfelt conversation. And they continue to disagree on this point, but Robinson gets off that conversation and says that Dr. King is still my leader. So when King is assassinated in April 1968, Robinson, like all other decent white Americans and Black Americans, is absolutely shattered. He goes to the funeral, and there's this great picture in the book where you can see that his face is absolutely shattered. He's so disappointed. And at this point, you're right, he is part of the old guard that King represented. He's part of that old guard that represented racial integration, that represented opposition to the use of any means necessary. And so he's sort of alienated from this younger group that's coming, that's represented by Stokely Carmichael and later by H. Rapp Brown. And I'll let Randall Jokes pick up from here.
Yeah, I you know, there was a generation gap, as it always is. The next generation comes along, thinks, oh, what the old people did, oh, you know, that really doesn't matter. And they lopped the old generation together. I think what the newer generation saw is that these power structures were much more deeply entrenched, which Jackie Robinson himself saw. This is why he abandons the Republican Party with the Goldwater campaign. I mean, the means by which they are going about it, the means are totally different. The younger generation is all influenced by Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, and they are saying, okay, this system is so bad that we might have to have a new American Revolution, and so they are trying to. Dr. King is trying to figure this out too. And where do we go from here? Chaos or community? That book is a response to that era. And Jackie is the older era by their accounts. Martin Luther King was considered the old guard, and he was only 38 years old.
We'd be considered ancient guard at this point.
But I do think there was just different. There were different viewpoints, and they were. I want to always defend Stokely because I think Stokely Carmichael gets a bad rap in this sense. He was a nonviolent protester. He was part of SNCC. I really do think the assassination of Martin Luther King transformed everybody in that regard. It was so, I think Michael put it well, it was so devastating that if they could kill King, well, who could they not assassinate? And of course, you know, 1964, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, 63, I mean, and the list goes on, and that all the unnamed people who were just simply protesting for the right to be U.S. citizens. So everybody was disenchanted. And sort of Robinson didn't know how to respond. And of course you have young Muhammad Ali saying, mm-hmm. I'm not going to the war on those grounds. So even though somebody like Jim Brown said, well, why don't you just do this and get it over with and you won't have to serve. But there's a difference. And Robinson's a World War II vet. And that makes, and yeah. Like my father was a Korea vet. That's a different generation. They saw that as their duty. Young people saw this, rightly so, and the King came to see it too, rightly so, as an unjust there's probably never any just war, but unjust war, and that it's taking away from all the needs of the central cities.
Hopton, may I follow up there?
Sure.
There's a really interesting turn that Robinson makes with the Nixon's election in 1968, I think. So in 1969, the New York Times is writing an article on the U.S. flag, and it reaches out to Robinson for comment. And he says, and in this year, Gulf Oil is distributing flag decals to Americans everywhere. My family had one on their Ford. I can still see it, a flag decal on our old Ford. And Robinson says in this interview, when I see a flag decal like that, I just figure that person isn't my friend. And part of his point here is that the flag has become so captive to the conservative movement led by Nixon at this point. And Robinson is opposing those who had this knee-jerk reaction to Black civil rights. He's also opposing those who had this uncritical reaction to Nixon and the war. So he's making this really interesting turn in 1969. And he says in this article that I can't salute the flag anymore. And then in 72, he makes this case in his autobiography that I can't stand for the national anthem, I can't salute the flag, and so forth. And it, around the same time, he starts to support the Black Panthers, which is really fascinating to me, Randall. But yeah, they're having some trouble in New York City. And Robinson comes out, he visits their headquarters, and he talks about the right of Black folks to defend themselves. And he's doing this with the Black Panther Party. So Robinson's considered the old guard, but wow, he's really making some headway, some really significant changes by the end of his life.
Yeah, and I think you know, we capture people like people want to capture him at 47, that he's trying to grow. He recognizes that the Black Panther Party are feeding children, that the government's not doing, and he knew what it meant to be a child with less than. And so I think he recognizes that these young people are doing things, and they're getting pigeonholed as well.
I want to talk a little bit about his relationship with Roy Wilkins and Martin Luther King and how he was stuck in the middle. And interesting enough, going back to his becoming really bolder as he got older, at one point he called for Roy Wilkins to step aside and let the Young Turks rise to power. How many old school generation leaders do that?
Well, you know, actually, when I wrote a book on Benjamin Mays, they're all quietly saying, Roy, you're kind of out of step. Mays was on the national board of the NAACP, but all of these people are gently urging Roy to step in and keep track of what people are saying. And, you know, we all get stuck in our ways, and there certainly needs to be a bigger and better biography of Roy Wilkins, of yes. One of the people, very, very much so, because he's from St. Paul, Minnesota. And so, yeah, but Wilkins is thinking he's defending, like Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall thought the protesters were just young rabble rousers on the bus ride, the freedom rides and other stuff. And he thought only way is to go was legal, right? And the kind of legal methodology, you go to court, you protract the cases. And of course, young people say, well, we don't have any time for that. And Roy Wilkins is so sort of stuck in the institutional years of the NAACP. I think both Robinson and others had called for, gently were trying to persuade him to either open up, listen to what others had to say. And he wasn't very good at that.
I agree. I think we really do need a major biography of Wilkins. We haven't seen anything like that for a long time, and the time is overdue. There's a lot of information out there. I was actually going through some of Wilkins' old columns a couple weeks ago. You know, early on, he was pretty radical in his perspective. And so was the NAACP. I mean, they were marching, they were protesting, they were picketing in the early 1900s. And I think, wow, I wish that had continued. And I think Robinson wishes that would have continued it as well. I do believe that he saw the NAACP under Wilkins' leadership as autocratic. I think he saw it as stuck in legal work. And yeah, I totally agree with Randall about this. Now, who were these young Turks who were trying to take over the leadership role? I guess they were folks like Clarence Jones or Clarence Mitchell, right, and others in the NAACP, and they would have taken that in an entirely new direction.
Right, right.
The book opens with an essay by Howard Bryant, who wrote an incredible history of Blacks activism, Black athletes activism a couple of years ago. I think it was called The Heritage.
Yeah.
And it opens with an essay called The Owner. And it was a very interesting take, which is he felt Jackie Robinson looked at it as this is ownership, just as I should have these rights as I breathe the air, as opposed to advancement, which was always the powers in place, always want to allow you to gain your rights incrementally and want you to be patient. I thought that was just such a nuanced but on point description of what is owed to us by right, by birth, as opposed to people saying, take your time and be patient. And Jackie Robinson represented that.
You know, early on, Robinson was smitten by President Eisenhower. He eventually turns on him on this very point. Eisenhower, to say that he was a gradualist is to be generous, I think, in some ways. But he was so moderate, so modulated. And one of the reasons that Robinson turns to Nixon in 1960, not only because Nixon helped steer passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, Nixon had visited Africa and so forth, but he had personally promised Robinson that he would move faster on issues of civil rights. At the same time, Kennedy was telling Robinson he wasn't too familiar with civil rights, and Kennedy wouldn't look Robinson in the eye in a one-on-one meeting in Georgetown. So Robinson goes with Nixon on this very point, which is fascinating to me. Of course, Nixon turns out to be a gradualist too. But yeah, you know, I really like Howard Bryant's essay, and it shows how there was an alignment between Robinson and Malcolm X too. I mean, Malcolm X was clamoring for Black ownership, right? It's not good enough to sit at the counter, and it's not good enough to have some money in your back pocket even to buy food at an integrated counter. We should own the store, Malcolm X was saying, and Robinson loved that. As a Black capitalist, he believed in Black ownership. Randall, want to follow up on that?
Yeah, no, I think that was absolutely right. And that was the Republican Party, the small kind of Midwestern Gerald Ford Republican Party, had called for, you know, the ma and pa store, the business owner, and lots of people felt that way. That if we own our own, we'd be just fine. And of course, Hopeton, you and I grew up in New Orleans, and we knew a lot of people who felt that I'd rather own my own little tiny store and be able to take care of my family. And that was a source of pride. That's a long-held American tradition, that ownership, having your store ownership, having your barber's ownership. That's what both Malcolm and Jackie prized. I mean, that sense of, and that's what my father got out of Mr. Robinson as well. I mean, that, okay, that I should be in business for myself, own when I get out of baseball, own. So all these young people, all these young athletes, LeBron and all of them, owe Jackie Robinson a whole bunch of things. And it was beyond that. But Jackie's relationship with Nixon, as everybody's relationship with Nixon, was always fraught because you wouldn't know if you could trust him. And of course, what turns the tide for Kennedy is Robert Kennedy's call to credit Scott King when Martin King is jailed for protesting in Atlanta and put way out in the boondocks. That made the difference in the election. Kennedy and Nixon's civil rights stance, if you put them on paper one-to-one like I do for students and say, huh. And my students say, well, there's not much that different. So, there you go. And you had to push them to make that difference.
But I want to come back to Howard Bryant's point, not the entrepreneurial point, but the stance on the rights are owed to us. We don't have to wait until you say it's okay. We shouldn't have to wait for you to say, you know, like you said, incremental, gradual, be patient. Yeah. And how Jackie Robinson was steadfast per the essay Howard Bryant wrote on the importance of owning.
Yeah, I would argue that that is also part and part of his religious beliefs, right? That God makes all of us. All of us are made equal before God. There is no hierarchy of human beings. And that's his constant faith and belief in that. And I think that comes out of his religious traditioning.
Yeah, I think Randall is absolutely right on this point. You know, I'm going to push it a little bit because Mally taught Jackie and her other kids this really interesting story about Adam and Eve. But it goes this way, has this really interesting twist. She taught Jackie that Adam and Eve were originally black.
Yes, he did.
And then they were scared white when God caught Eve eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so he grows up. Randall, maybe you can help me here.
But you know, Elijah Muhammad, they're both Georgians. They both utter the kind of same thing. I mean, look at the cosmology of the Nation of Islam, that they kind of have the same. When I noted that, I was like, oh, Elijah Poole, Elijah Muhammad, they both have this kind of rate about Georgia is so violent and the lynchings are so much that they retell the biblical story in a different kind of way. Yeah. Scared white.
Right. Oh. Yeah. I was hoping one of you guys, I was feeling uncomfortable that I was the only one laughing, but you know, I was trying to decide, am I going to have to edit this portion out?
Not at all.
Well, let's close. We have to talk about Rachel because, you know, throughout the book, there's a sense, and this is my reading, there's a sense of how Rachel is involved, wants to be involved in shaping his legacy because she felt like the Pee Wee Reese story was false about him putting his arm around the shoulders of Jackie Robinson, that there was all this mythological stuff about Jackie Robinson that was being put out there that just wasn't true. And also, as you mentioned earlier, Randall, her influence coming from her background in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And to me, just this powerful couple that without her, would Jackie Robinson even become who he became?
Well, I'll quote Michelle Obama from the Ken Burns documentary. She looks at Barack and says, you see, that's what you have a great partner.
And I think I love that part.
I think Jackie Robinson was very wise because she breaks up with him, you know. I mean, she breaks up with him because he's kind of holding up on her becoming a nurse and all of this other stuff. He's pretty typical guy of his day, you know. Yeah. And he realizes that he can't do what he wants to do without this partner, his loving partner at his side.
You know, on October 24th, 1972, Robinson is in the shower and Rachel is in the kitchen and it's morning and she hears Jack, she called him Jack. She hears Jack call her name and she knows something's wrong and she runs out and she sees him standing there in the hallway and he's dripping wet. And he grabs a hold of her and gives her a big hug, tells her that he loves her, and then he falls down and dies. And wow, what a fitting end to the relationship. It was a relationship of love that really sustained both of them through those hard times. And I tell that story just to give some indication of the intimacy that those two must have had to rely on through not only 45 and 46 and 47, but through hard times far beyond that. I mean, Jackie Jr. Suffered with drugs, as we know, and then ended up dying after, while he was in recovery and doing really well. They had some really tough times. And it was because they had each other that they made a way out of no way.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that I was trying to point out in my essay is that there were different kinds of Methodisms within the United States, and that she came from a particular tradition, and a Methodism that we should recognize both of those traditionings. And he got a lot of even more backbone, he was a pretty tough guy, but more backbone from her, and which she had. They were a powerful couple, and they were a couple. Yeah,
right. And Amira Rose Davis makes a case in the book that Rachel really played a key role in helping introduce women's rights to Robinson. Yes. There are a couple movements he missed along the way, and the women's movement was one of them, especially in the early 70s. But Rachel did she was a huge supporter of women's rights, and she helped Jack along the way on that point. Well, you know, she's a great leader herself. She led the Jackie Robinson Foundation after he died, and has supplied or has granted numerous scholarships to young students of color. Randall, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I was going to just say, yeah, she was, by breaking up with him and saying, I have the right to go to school and be what I want to be, she's asserting herself as a woman. Yeah. And he says, well, I love this woman. I better get with the program. Right.
Yeah.
Michael G. Long, editor of Jack 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and his Legacy, Randall Maurice Jelks, one of the contributing essayists to 42 Today. Thank you both for being guests on KEZI Book Review.
Thank you.
Oh, I never have interviews like this. I don't know about you, Randall, but this is a nice, deep, substantive interview. So thanks a lot, Houston. Thanks, Randall.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. Subscribe to us under Hopeton Hay Podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many other sources of podcasts. If you like this interview, be sure to rate it. Rate it a 5. Give us 5 stars. You can follow KAZI Book Review on Twitter under @KAZIBooks. You can also follow us under Facebook under KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay. And you can also follow us on Instagram under KAZI_book_review. Thank you once again for listening to the KAZI Book Review podcast.